Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Later this week, MU will host a panel discussion exploring the civil rights history of the university. The talk, which takes place this Thursday night at the Missouri Theater, is just one of a number of events scheduled across town to honor Black History Month. Locally, much has improved since the days of Jim Crow, but some believe that more can be done to make Columbia a more inclusive community. Today on Intersection, we'll take a look back at some of the civil rights gains at the university and the town at large, and talk about the lessons that can be learned from them. Joining me in studio, Michael Middleton is MU's deputy chancellor. Prior to that, he was a professor in the university's School of Law. He was also the first African-American student to enroll and graduate from MU's law school. Michael, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
And Bill Horner is a professor of political science at MU and the co-author of a book on Lloyd Gaines, who was an early civil rights pioneer who challenged the law school's ban on African-American students. William, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
And we'd also love to hear from you in our audience. If you want to join in on today's conversation, give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And yeah, so maybe just to start chronologically, I guess, with you, Bill, talking about Lloyd Gaines. First, who was Lloyd Gaines?
Well, Lloyd Gaines was a graduate of Lincoln University. He grew up at least part of his childhood in St. Louis, and he was a graduate of Vachon High School in St. Louis. And then he went to Lincoln and graduated in 1935. He majored in history. He was an honors graduate. He was president of his class in 1935, and then he became part of an effort, an ongoing effort of the NAACP to challenge segregation in institutions all over the country, but Missouri was one place that they were interested in pursuing, and so Gaines ended up walking into the office of the attorneys in St. Louis that were sort of handling things at a more local level for the national NAACP, and that's sort of how the process got started.
Right. And his legal challenge was a pretty big one. I mean, went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Sure. Yeah. No, he and his attorneys at the national level was Charles Houston, who was the sort of coordinator of the legal efforts for the NAACP nationally. And he worked very closely with Thurgood Marshall. At the local level, there were a couple of attorneys, Sidney Redman and Henry Espy in St. Louis. And together Gaines applied for admission to the law school and sort of in the process of making that application, made it known that he was African American, and in requesting his transcript from Lincoln, made it quite clear that he was African American. Mm-hmm. And at which point the university just sort of sat on his application and didn't do anything with it. And so there was some effort made to get court order to essentially force the university to acknowledge the application, make a decision on the application, and then it proceeded from there. You know, once the university, the board of curators officially voted, which, you know, it's hard to imagine the board of curators getting involved in an individual student admission ordinarily, but it was a board of curators vote ultimately to decide not to let him in. And so then the suit was filed in Boone County Courthouse, and that was heard there in 1936. And they lost at the circuit court level, and it went to the Missouri Supreme Court, and they lost at the Missouri Supreme Court, which was all okay as far as the NAACP was concerned, because they had won a fairly significant victory in Maryland in a case called Murray versus Pearson, that you know, desegregated the law school at the University of Maryland. But the problem was that Maryland chose not to pursue that case to the Supreme Court, which is what they really needed to have happen so that they could set that national level precedent. And so that was all okay. It was expected that they were going to lose all along the way. And so then the case went to was heard in the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of 1938.
Right. And Michael Middleton, what was your perspective on that as an MU law student as well? And we'll talk more about the significance of that for you personally later too. But I guess what did you think about this case in the scheme of civil rights here in Missouri, I guess specifically, and across the country?
Well, this case was an important case in the civil rights movement generally. Interesting to note, the Murray case, you know, the NAACP picked University of Maryland for their initial lawsuit because Thurgood Marshall had been denied admission to the University of Maryland Law School. Mm-hmm. So he decided to do his law school.
Yeah.
And you're right. He was shocked when the state court simply agreed and the university agreed to integrate. So Missouri was the number two target. No, I was aware of the Gaines case when I was contemplating law school, and it was a motivator for me, as it was for many people in the early 60s who were involved in the civil rights movement. The other thing that's interesting is that Lloyd Gaines was a fraternity brother of mine, so I knew of him through fraternity lore as well.
Well, and we should mention too, I guess I guess what happened to Lloyd Gaines. We don't really know, I guess, as part of the story.
But. Yeah, that's the troubling part. After he and I don't want to steal from the book, and I don't want to get anything wrong from the book. But my recollection is that while awaiting appeals, when the Supreme Court's ruling was in effect. That the separate but equal doctrine of Plessy versus Ferguson was the standard,
right.
And ordered that the state of Missouri either admit Lloyd Gaines to the University of Missouri Law School or create a separate but equal law school for African Americans in Missouri. The response to that was that the state authorized the establishment of a Lincoln University School of Law. They rented or bought a building in St. Louis. I think they invested a couple hundred thousand dollars in books for a law library, and they hired two or three professors, lawyers, to be professors. So then the question for the NAACP was whether the Lincoln Law School was in fact equal to the University of Missouri Law School. They went back to court. The Supreme Court remanded the case back to the state court. They came back to Boone County Court. They were apparently preparing for a hearing to determine whether the Lincoln Law School was equal to the Missouri Law School. And while preparing, someone asked, well, where is Lloyd?
Yep.
Lloyd did not show up to help the lawyers prepare. What they discovered was that Lloyd had been in Chicago at the Alpha House, the fraternity house, living there. He left the frat house one evening, allegedly to go buy some stamps, according to the reports that were made, left the fraternity house and was never seen again. And so no one knows what happened to Lloyd Gaines. I heard a story, and I don't know that you've heard it in doing your book, but there was a judge in East St. Louis, Billy Jones, who reported to someone that he was with Lloyd Gaines in St. Louis and saw him get on a train to Columbia. That was the last reported sighting I've heard of Lloyd Gaines, but I don't know that I got. Have you heard anything like that?
We have. We've heard lots of different stories.
Yeah. Lots of theories.
Yeah. There are many theories. And of course, the story has evolved over time, too, mm-hmm. because, initially there was some – and the letter, he wrote a letter to his mother, which indicates, if you read the letter, suggests some great frustration on his part with the process mm-hmm. and the pressure of being involved, being the center of this incredible – legal battle and considerable negative, reaction to it. And So the letter reads, you know, he says things in there about, if you don't hear from me, don't worry about me. And he says, there's a great passage, which I can't do off the top of my head, unfortunately, but a very eloquent passage about how I'm not a great man. You know, people want to make me a great man. Sometimes I wish I was just an ordinary man. And so, you know, I think at the time there was speculation that he had maybe had enough.
Made himself disappear.
But when somebody disappears and isn't heard from, you know, for years and years and years and years, you imagine if somebody has relocated, eventually somebody's going to see them. So that then becomes speculation about whether or not he met a violent end. And we don't know.
I just need to take a moment to remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're taking a look back at some of the civil rights issues at the university and the town at large and talking about the lessons that can be learned from them. Joining me in studio, Michael Middleton is MU's Deputy Chancellor. He was also the first African-American student to enroll and graduate from MU's law school. William Horner is a professor of political science at MU and the co-author of a book on Lloyd Gaines, who was an early civil rights pioneer who challenged the law school's ban on African-American students. And now joining us by phone, Mary Ratliff is the president of the state chapter of the NAACP. She's lived in Columbia since 1959. Mary, thanks for joining us. And for you and our audience, how inclusive is MU? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Okay. Sorry, Deputy Chancellor Middleton. Sorry for interrupting you there.
No, I was thinking another rumor I heard, consistent with the notion that Lloyd Gaines may have just gotten frustrated and wanted to get away. Dr. Lorenzo Green, a noted historian from Lincoln University, said at one time that he heard a rumor that Lloyd Gaines was in Mexico, the country of Mexico.
Yes.
And he apparently took a trip down there looking for Lloyd Gaines, got to a town where someone told him there was an African-American man from Missouri working at a coal mine, I believe, in the area. And Lorenzo went looking for him, but couldn't find him. So
had gone so far as to arrange to meet for lunch.
Is that right?
And showed up at the restaurant,
and he didn't show up.
Come right, yeah.
So
yeah.
Who knows what happened? But it's a tragic story. But you can't deny the toll that ordeal must have taken on Lloyd Gaines.
Sure.
Lloyd Gaines, you know, was the valedictorian of his high school graduating class, magna cum laude from Lincoln. I think he wanted, in fact, to be a teacher, but he was basically recruited into this movement to serve as the ultra-qualified plaintiff in this lawsuit. And that's the way the civil rights litigation model goes.
Yeah.
You find a target defendant, and you find a squeaky clean, ultra-qualified plaintiff. You have him apply for the job or for admission or whatever it is the barrier you're trying to break. Mm. So there can be no dispute as to his objective qualifications.
Mm.
That simply bolsters your case that, well, if they rejected him, it was because of his race.
Right.
Of course, in this case, it was clear that it was because of his race.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you know, Lloyd Gaines stepped up and gave himself to the movement. And he was a part of a great victory, but you always question the benefit that plaintiff derives from that kind of courage.
Well, and that's really the point, right? In a sense, it doesn't. I mean, it is a great mystery of history, right? What happened to Gaines? But in either case, it's a very sad story, because no matter what reason he disappeared for, it's because of, you know, he was basically, you know, really just put through the grinder in this in this process as being part of this and playing this heroic role that somebody had to play.
Mm-hmm. And then, so how long did it take, though, for MU to then become desegregated after this case?
1950 was the first. There was a small group of students that were pursuing, and it was all graduate education in the beginning. And that was part of Charles Houston's plan with the NAACP, was to use graduate education. And one of the reasons that states like Missouri and Maryland were targets were because originally were because they, and Missouri was sort of a, unfortunately, it's good to be a pioneer in some things, but Missouri was a pioneer in offering scholarships for African-American students to go out of state to study. There was no law school at Lincoln at the time when Gaines filed his suit.
So that's how they handled the separate but equal, right?
By saying
we can send you somewhere else completely separate out of the state.
Right. And just as always the case with separate but equal, facilities were never equal, and the scholarships that were offered were nowhere near enough to pay the expenses of somebody to go and study, beside the fact that, you're a tax-paying citizen of the state of Missouri, you should be able to go to the institution in the state of Missouri. So, anyway.
And who's to say that? Who can say that a law education in Kansas is equal to one in Missouri?
Well, but, that was one of the amazing things that the state tried to argue. That the law school, in the case, tried to argue. They had the dean of the law school on the stand here in the Boone County Courthouse arguing that there was no particular advantage to studying law in the state of Missouri if you wanted to practice law in the state of Missouri, that you could get just as good an education in Illinois or Kansas. It was a ridiculous conceit.
Right.
And that, the first thing they tried to argue was that Lincoln University was a substandard institution, when all along, the case that they had made to justify segregation in the first place in higher education was that Lincoln was the equal of the University of Missouri. So the first thing that they considered arguing, and they floated this argument, there's great memos from Charles Houston about this, and he's thinking, let them make that argument. But they were originally going to argue that no student from Lincoln could be possibly qualified to go to law school at the University of Missouri. And they shifted from that to arguing that there was nothing special about the University of Missouri Law School. Mm-hmm. So, it was a ridiculous exercise.
I'd like to bring in Mary real quick. Mary, why do you think that Gaines is a significant figure? We've been talking about this a little bit here, but
as Mike was saying, I think that it's significant that that he, when we are looking for civil rights people, as Mike has said, we are looking for someone who can cleanly represent the community. And that when we can see no other reason except for the fact that the color of their skin, when we're trying to make breakthroughs, in racial disparity cases. And I think that it's important for Lord Gaines or Rosa Parks or any of those kinds of people that are willing to really really go out on the limb. To make society better, because that's what they do. The price that he paid, we don't even know the ultimate price that he paid for deciding to take that step. We know that Rosa Parks had many obstacles thrown in her way when she decided to. So we owe so much to those pioneers who were brave enough to go ahead of us and try to pave a way for us. And Lord Gaines is no different. So, I think that in his time, he could have with his education from Lincoln University, he could have decided to have been a teacher and gone quietly on his way over there, But he, for the movement, he was willing to put himself out there and maybe even gave his life for that cause.
Well, yeah, and everyone, school kids know the name Rosa Parks, but they don't know the name Lloyd Gaines. You can guess about what may have happened if he hadn't disappeared. Do you think he'd be as revered maybe as someone like that, like you're talking about, in a wider scale?
I would think that certainly he would be one of the people that we would be celebrating during, Black History Month and other times. Anytime we have, someone who willing to go that length to stick their necks out, especially during that period of time when it was dangerous, I think, yes, he would have been a historical figure that we would be celebrating.
Yeah. Bill, I saw you want to jump in there.
Well, I was going to say, and the deputy chancellor was getting at this, when he, at the time he disappeared, they were preparing the next case, and the next case would have been to, in a way, for higher education at least, this could have been Brown versus the Board of Education, because the next step was to challenge the obvious fact that the school they set up in St. Louis was not the equivalent of the University of Missouri Law School. And the court seemed inclined. It was a 6-2 decision in Gaines versus Canada. I mean, it was not a the 5-4 decisions that we see today in so many cases. It was a pretty solid majority.
Right.
And it very well could have been that had they been able to pursue this, that Gaines would be, we'd talk about the Gaines decision, you know,
Absolutely.
In the second case.
Absolutely. Could have been.
Yeah. I want to take a moment to remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Familiner, and today we're taking a look back at some of the civil rights issues at the university and the town at large and talking about the lessons that can be learned from them. Joining me in studio, Michael Middleton is MU's Deputy Chancellor. He also was the first African-American student to enroll and graduate from MU's law school. William Horner is a professor of political science at MU and the co-author of a book on Lloyd Gaines, who was an early civil rights pioneer who challenged the law school's ban on African-American students. And joining us by phone, Mary Ratliff is the president of the state chapter of the NAACP and has lived in Columbia since 1959. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. Were you involved in the civil rights movement in Columbia? How has the city changed? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. And Deputy Chancellor Middleton, I've been mentioning it in those intros throughout, but you know, you have a pretty close connection with Lloyd Gaines because you were the first African American student law student mm-hmm. here. So what was that experience like knowing the story of Lloyd Gaines and being here at the university, you know, I guess 30 years after this, yeah. this fight happened?
Well, let me make one correction. I wasn't the first.
Oh, okay.
Apparently when MU integrated, Lincoln Law School became unnecessary, mm-hmm. and they closed it down. I was told by Dean Willard Eckhart when I came here to law school that when Lincoln Law School closed, there were 6 or 7 African-American students who, in fact, were admitted into MU's law school to complete their legal education. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing was, though they graduated, they didn't get MU degrees. Mm-hmm. They were retroactively given Lincoln degrees. Mm-hmm. That was, I think, in the 50s. I came to MU as a freshman in 64, and I entered law school in 68. There were 2 African Americans in law school in 68, both of whom had transferred from Howard University Law School. They went there for a year or two and came back to Mizzou for the express purpose of getting an MU law degree because they were both from Missouri. One, Harold Holliday, from Kansas City, whose father was a state yeah. legislator, mm-hmm. and one Linwood Evans from St. Louis. So there were 2 older fellows in their second and third year when I came in as a first-year student in the law school. Mm-hmm. They helped me immensely. They knew the ropes. They were at least someone I could talk to, mm-hmm. someone who could take me under their wings and help out. So I was the first to enter as a freshman and graduate as a 3L, but mm-hmm. I don't want to take any of the recognition away from those who sure. preceded me as law students.
Sure.
It was not easy. It was, you know, my first year, indeed my undergraduate and law school careers were interesting. I say it wasn't. Let me precede this with the fact that I was born in Mississippi. I'm well aware of segregation and racism, mm-hmm. and because that's what I grew up with. So it wasn't shocking to come to Columbia mm-hmm. or to come to MU because the atmosphere was very much like the atmosphere was in Mississippi growing mm-hmm. up. So it may surprise you to realize that it wasn't a shock. It mm-hmm. was just more of the same. Mm-hmm. that I grew up fighting against. So I could deal with it. But it wasn't pleasant. I mean, to be in a classroom and not be called on ever and not know if they were not calling on you because they thought you were a dummy and they were protecting you, or were they not calling on you because they just didn't want to interact with an African American? Mm-hmm. I mean, those thoughts go through a student's mind. Or when you do get addressed, it's on a race issue. You know, you're the expert on that. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of things happened.
all the time throughout undergraduate and throughout law school. But even as I say that, there were professors and there were colleagues, other students, who were a bit more progressive and welcoming. And, you know, you gravitate to those folks who will interact with you and you get by. I still have some very good friends from law school. Some of my classmates, study partners, are to this day, here some 40 or 50 years later, good friends. So it wasn't as bad as some may think, but it was a whole lot worse than others may think.
If I can ask, how did the I'm fascinated at the notion of how the undergraduate experience compared to your law school experience, mm-hmm. in those terms, you know, of how you were accepted and what the experience was like.
It was about the same. It took me a year of law school. Back in those days, you know, a third of law students didn't get past their first year. Once I made it through the first year, I was much more accepted.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people began to say, oh, he must be...
He's for real.
Yeah, he's for real. Yeah. And so it was much better in the second and third year than the first year. In the first year, I was pretty much isolated. I just didn't know anybody, and no one wanted to deal with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you able to kind of get past the idea that it was something about you and, you know, the idea of it's their approach, not you. You know what I mean?
I learned that as a very young child.
Yeah.
That when you're faced with racism, it's not about you; it's about them.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, it's important not to be angry or judgmental about them.
Mm-hmm.
Racism is something that people learn. And a kid, a young adult, or even an older adult who has this, in our view, you know, inexplicable notion of racial inferiority, can't help it. That's what they learned. And being angry or vindictive is not a solution. You need to help them work through it. Demonstrate to them that they're wrong. Don't tell them they're wrong necessarily. Demonstrate to them that they're wrong, and perhaps you move the ball forward. So no, it was never an internal doubt about me.
Mm-hmm.
It was more a sadness about them.
You mentioned some of the students that reached out to you, but was there anywhere on the campus that you did feel welcome or comfortable? I mean, I guess it maybe got better as time went on, but.
Yeah, I met some friends in the residence hall, in Jones Hall. In fact, the former poet laureate of Missouri, Walter Bargan, lived down the hall from me over in Jones Hall. Good guy, got to be a good friend. In law school, I had several good friends that I hung with, studied with. One of our curators now, John Phillips, was a study partner of mine in law school. So, yeah, I mean, there were people who were genuinely good people, good progressive people. But the vast majority of people, I mean, when you're walking across campus to go to class and someone throws a half-empty beer can out of a car window and yells, "Go home," N-word, and that's your greeting on your first day on campus, it kind of goes downhill from there.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break. We'll continue this discussion after that break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're taking a look back at some of the civil rights issues at the university and the town at large and talking about the lessons that can be learned from them. Our guests in studio today are Michael Middleton, Bill Horner, and Mary Ratliff. I'm Ryan Femuelner. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're taking a look back at some of the civil rights issues at the university and the town at large and talking about the lessons that can be learned from them. Joining me in studio, Michael Middleton is MU's deputy chancellor. He was also the first African-American student to enroll and graduate from MU's law school, though we had a short correction on that earlier. We're also joined by Bill Horner. He's a professor of political science at MU and the co-author of a book on Lloyd Gaines, who was an early civil rights pioneer and challenged the law school's ban on African-American students. And Mary Ratliff is joining us by phone. She's the president of the state chapter of the NAACP and has lived in Columbia since 1959. And for you and our audience, do you think Columbia is an inclusive community? What could be done to make it more inclusive? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you could join our online chat. And, Michael, maybe that's a good question to ask you, I guess. Did you see, coming to the University of Missouri, did you see a difference between your reception in the community in Columbia or on campus? Or what were some of the – or was it all kind of the same, I guess?
It was all kind of the same. I mean, yeah. Columbia was pretty much a small town at that time. There was still segregation downtown. I don't recall ever really – trying to do anything in Columbia, because the word I got was that there was so much segregation there. You kind of avoid trying to go into a restaurant if you know they're going to throw you out. Mary might be better at explaining what Columbia was like in those days than I. I spent most of my time on campus. I didn't have a car, and I didn't really want to venture out into Columbia because of its reputation.
Yeah, and so Mary, you moved to Columbia, I guess, almost a decade earlier than...
I moved to Columbia actually in 59.
1959?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, what was your experience? I think, if I'm not mistaken, you had lived in Mississippi previously as well.
Yes, I did. As Mike had said, my joke for Columbia was that I moved to Big Little Dixie, okay, when I moved to Columbia. Because there was not a lot of change. And one of the things that I heard Mike talk about, one of the things that our parents and our teachers did for us when you start talking about the inferiority complexes for many of us, they taught us how people felt about us, but also instilled in us that our worth in us, that the discriminatory practice did not belittle us in any way. How people felt about us did not change who we were, and that's what my professors brought to me. But in Columbia, there was it was segregation. There was housing segregation in Columbia. The attitudes were still. It was like a little Dixie kind of attitude when you went to I spent a lot of time at the city council meetings with the Juana Faye Alberts, the George Brooks, and Jim Nunley, and those people working to change, going to the city council and really just almost being, that we just had to be civil disobedient to the council, because they didn't want to hear us when we were talking about issues that affected the African American community, whether we were talking about Blind Moon Center or whether we were talking about fair housing. And during that period of time, we had I heard Mike talk about Holiday, Harold Holiday. Harold Holiday was here in Columbia in law school during that period of time and worked very closely with the community. He and another student, James Rollin, who was over there in law school at the time, and Mike, you probably remember, heard the story of Jim Rollins, was over at that time, and they worked diligently with us here in Columbia to try to change the racial climate here in Columbia, and was received and very, very poorly. So there were there was just blatant racism in Columbia. Housing. I've told this story many times, but when we saved money to try to buy a house down on Sexton Road, those little white houses that are down there now, And the guy built three of them, and when we saved the money, worked very hard and tried to buy one of the houses, he said, sorry, I can't sell those other two if I sell the ones to you, you know. So there was, you know, just widespread. And one of the things that it was like in Colombia, because they didn't have, I think, the race rats and those sorts of things, it seems that the Colombia majority community felt that that everybody was just satisfied here. That Colombia was just a place that African-American folks were satisfied with because. And there was a lot of complacency here, and there was a lot of, you know, the truth of the matter is there was a lot of reluctance in the community and sometimes some ill feelings in the community for folks, for local folks, when some of us that were not willing to accept Colombia because of the attitude that it had, some of them felt that we were totally, you know, some of the African Americans felt that we were just totally too, aggressive in our efforts to desegregate Colombia. And sometimes that divided the community, especially, you know, when Rollins and Doc Holliday, they came over and worked very closely with us, and then they were saying, you know, you'll cause a problem here, and you're going to be gone, and we're going to still have a problem. And I can understand that, but the racism was for real here in Colombia. It was live, and it was difficult to tear down some of those barriers.
Sure.
In fact, the housing barriers, it was very difficult.
And when did things start to change? I mean, or have they changed enough? I don't know. When did things, you know, you mentioned the battles you had to fight at city council, things like that.
Okay, things changed, but you know, I don't know if he wants me to say this, but one of the I call his name, but one of the pathologists, well thought of pathologists here came to Columbia, and I'm terrible with dates, so you know I don't remember the dates exactly. It must have been it was late. It must have been 72-ish, 73-ish, or something like that. One of the professors came to work at the VA and was basically denied housing right off Providence Road down there between Stadium and I forget that neighborhood, what that neighborhood's called, on Providence Road and Stadium, the corner of Providence Road and Stadium, that those houses off there to the north. He was a pathologist and wanted to rent a house there, and his technician was renting the house in that area and built a new house, and then informed her tenant that she was going to move, but she had talked to this pathologist who had been to her house, and they wanted to rent it since she was going to move out of it. And so she said she hadn't told her landlord, so she was going to tell her landlord, and that she had, you know, some very qualified folks to rent it to. And then when she went to them, they said, fine, that's great. She just said, my pathologist, my boss, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, fine, you know, go ahead. And she said, and when he was looking at it, he was saying that there was some problem with the fireplace and the chimney and all. And she said, yeah. And he said, well, that would need to be fixed before, if he was to decide to rent it. And he said, no problem. This is all by phone. No problem. So when can you look at it? So he said, my wife and I will be over to look at it Sunday. And when they went over, the person met them at the door. The people that they were going to rent it from met them at the door and said to them, they told them who they were, and they said, sorry, someone was just here before you to rent it.
Yeah, and okay? This is the 70s.
And they had, someone was just here before you, and he said, I know that can't be true because my employee lives here. And my employee lives here, and my employee told me they told nobody that they were leaving when they were leaving because they were going to give me that first opportunity. And they said they were sorry, couldn't rent it to them. Mm-hmm. He contacted me from the NAACP, I called them to tell them that they had filed a complaint, the housing complaint, with me. And the tenant said at that time when I started questioning, she said, "You live in Columbia?" And I said, "Yes." It was a female. "You live in Columbia?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, that's why I remember, it was after 72. She said, "And who do you work for?" And my reply to her was, "I work for the federal government. Do you have any pool there?" You know. And she hung up. And she hung up. And so later on, she called me back and she said, "You could call my lawyer." You know,
mm-hmm.
And so I'm talking to the person, I'm talking to the pathologist, and he's getting, very, very upset about whether or not he's going to want to take this place. And I'm saying, "Now you got to do it now, you know, you got to restart this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, they call me back, and I was able to, she called me back, and she said, the lawyer called me back and said, "We're going to rent him the house, but we're not going to do any repairs." And I said, "Unacceptable, okay? That's unacceptable."
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Well, so we would not accept that, okay?
Right. And so,
Michael, I wonder too. I mean, you actually left Columbia for a while, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And then came back in the 80s. So,
yes.
In the time period we're talking about there with Mary's in the 70s, but did you see much change when you returned in the 80s and I guess since then?
Yeah, I saw change, but I saw the same change that I saw across the country. I mean, what I was doing during that 15-year period when I was gone, I was in Washington, D.C. with the Department of Justice doing civil rights law, and I litigated cases all over the country. I mean, what Mary is describing and what I've described to you of my experience in the 60s was happening all over the country.
Right.
And the entire country has moved beyond where we were then.
Yes.
I saw the change when I returned in the 80s from what Columbia was like in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen change in Columbia and at the university since I came back in 85 to 2014.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think what I'm saying is that this process of moving us forward.
Right.
I mean, I remember stories from my great-grandfather, who was one of the first African-American lawyers in the state of Mississippi. He was admitted to the bar in 1895. And there are stories in my family passed down from my grandfather and my mother that show that progress. I mean, that my parents lived in the 1920s in Mississippi and up to St. Louis to Chicago. I mean, those of us in the African-American community understand that history and see the change that has occurred over the last 50, 60, 70 years. And we appreciate the progress.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But we also know how much further there is that we need to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at the incarceration rates of African-American young people, you look at the education rates of African-Americans in this country, you look at the socioeconomic status of African-American families in this country, then you see that while we have made significant gains from the days of outright marginalization and rejection, we've made significant progress. We are still not where we need to be as a country or as a community right here in Columbia or as a university. And,
Absolutely. That's
not a harsh criticism. Mm-hmm. That's a recognition of the way societies and cultures evolve.
Mm-hmm. And we are not trying to say that great progress have not been made.
Yeah.
Because we've seen great progress. We've seen great progress in Columbia. What we are saying is that we have not reached that pinnacle where we can say that everything is equal. Everything, that there's no disparity, I guess I want to say.
Sure.
That there's no disparity. And so, we just have to keep working at it until we get to that point, and we know that we're nowhere near there yet.
Right. And take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuyiwa, and today we're taking a look back at some of the civil rights issues at the university and town at large and talking about the lessons that can be learned from them. Joining me in studio, Michael Middleton, is MU's Deputy Chancellor. Bill Horner is a professor of political science at MU and the co-author of a book on Lloyd Gaines. And Mary Ratliff is the president of the state chapter of the NAACP and has lived in Columbia since 1959. For you and our audience, do you think Columbia is truly integrated? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet at intersectkbia. So yeah, to that same point, you mentioned some of the big societal institutional factors, Michael, that are kind of blocking some real progress. But what can communities do? What can happen at Columbia? What can happen at MU to move things, to continue to move things forward?
If I had the answer to that, yeah, I'd be a gazillionaire.
Sure.
No, but I think what we can do is rely on young people becoming exposed to people of different cultures with different backgrounds in a climate like the university, where young people can come to the realization that skin color, sexual orientation, gender, and all of these things that in the past we've used to divide ourselves and create pecking orders for ourselves, all of those things are irrelevant to an individual's ability to contribute to society and advancing society. The more young people that we get to recognize that, the quicker we'll make progress.
And hop in there, we have to start with our young people. We have to start providing the opportunities prior to them getting to the university.
No question.
And we have to look at the barriers that keep them from getting to the university. And, of course, I keep talking about and referring everybody to the Youth Promise Act that Bobby Scott introduced, that's online that everybody can go on and look at, that is a good roadmap, a good first step to us working toward trying to get programs, et cetera, where our young people can be ready for the university, so they will be ready to enter into the workplace, into society, trained and ready to hit the ground running. And so that's where we have got to spend so much of our time trying to make those kinds of things happen in our community. And we need to just really look at our community to see what kind of resources that we have. We want to take our resources and send them off to Jefferson City, someplace to pay for prisoners, or do we want so they can come out and rob us again and kill us again or do whatever it is, or do we want to prepare young people on the front end to be productive citizens in our society? And that's our challenge.
Bill, I saw you want to jump in there.
Well, I was thinking when Mary was talking about violence against African Americans, I would be curious to know what the Deputy Chancellor and Mary think about what appears to be on the Supreme Court at the moment moving closer and edging closer and closer with a couple of cases now toward reversing what was just a decade ago settled policy with regard to affirmative action in higher education and where you think what the appropriate line is in that policy, because that's something we talk a lot about in my American government class. the court seems to be edging moving toward reversing itself in the Grutter versus Bollinger decision.
The court's been dancing around that issue for years.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're moving any closer to reversing policies of affirmative action in higher ed. I think they're fine-tuning and refining their definitions and their analysis, but they haven't backed away from the notion that it's appropriate to use race as a consideration among many in the admissions process, so long as that use is narrowly tailored to achieve a recognized, compelling governmental interest in a structure that at a university that benefits from diversity. Mm-hmm. So diversity is a compelling governmental interest. The Supreme Court has said that and not backed off. The latest decision they made in the Fisher case in Texas was essentially, people think of it as a reversal of a decision affirming the use of race there. What it in fact was a remand of that case to a lower court for them to make the judgment whether that narrow tailoring standard had been met. And the problem was that the district court accepted the word of the university rather than examining the facts itself to make that determination. So it was a procedural remand that didn't really change the law. Well, but as you say, I mean there is a tendency towards restricting the use of race in these decisions, and I don't know where the court's going to go. You know, politics have changed.
Yeah, it depends on who's sitting on the court at the time that the case, you know, comes up, and that's why it is so important who sits on the Supreme Court. We know that we feel that we're in kind of on I don't feel quite as confident as Mike does that affirmative action portion is not being undermined. But we are struggling, the NACP and our legal team is working very, very hard to make sure that we keep that portion of it intact. Sure. So we'll see how that all weighs out. But I know we're spending a lot of time and effort in that arena right now.
Sure. And Mary, as we get closer to the end of the show here, I've asked you what you thought about Columbia throughout time, but what do you think about Columbia today in regards to race relations?
I think that Columbia has come an awful long way, as I said, since '69 in the area of race relations. I think the culture of Columbia is still there's a lot of. There's still a lot of segregation going on. You walk down the stores in Broadway, you go into the banks, the insurance companies, and all of those different areas, and when you don't see people that look at all like you, then you know that that Columbia have not moved to the point where it ought to be. And so, you know, that's our challenge to keep bringing. However, I think as long as you can keep the dialogue open where you can communicate and talk, and that's what we can do nowadays that were not available to us in the past when we went to the council in the past, is that nobody was listening. You know, you had nobody to listen to you, and now we see some changes made because of the fact that we are at the table and we are making suggestions, et cetera, such as with commissions and task forces and those sorts of things. So I think there is that attempt to tear down some of those walls and barriers that have so long divided us. However, in saying that, I still say that Columbia needs to think more about when it talks about diversity, and when I look at the diversity breakfast, et cetera, we're still in a state of assimilation, where, you know, we go to activities that are sponsored by, you know, the city and the community and all. When we come back to our communities for, like the Martin Luther King celebration and all, you know, we fill up the executive center, but on Monday we have the activity and we have 150 or 200 people show up, you know, and we have 25 or 30 white individuals show up for that, that occasion, as if that's in the black community. So we don't need to you know, we don't need to go there. And if we're going to have, if we're going to have an affair that encompasses the whole community, too many times we have areas in Columbia that will house a number of people for a number of meetings, but many of the times we put them into, we say we have to put them into the majority community and then invite the minority community in, instead of everybody supporting everything that goes on citywide in the community. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is that we are talking about, I'm talking about, you know, integration versus assimilation.
Right. And Michael, I wonder your thoughts on that too, and I guess specifically on campus, knowing your role here at MU.
Well, you know, there was a book written or an article written about high schools. Why do all the black kids eat in the cafeteria together or something? And you know, that flashed in my mind as Mary was talking. I don't know. I don't know how much opportunity there is for the majority community to participate with in activities in the African American community. I know a few folks do. I don't know how comfortable people feel integrating towards the black community versus black community integrating towards the white community. I think that's a very complex issue, and I think Mary raises a good point that people really need to think about that and see how they can go both ways in this area of integrating. I hadn't really thought about it that much because I kind of go both ways by virtue of what I do in this community. But that's a very good issue an area where there needs to be some serious thought amongst all of us.
Mm-hmm. Got absolutely.
Just about 30 seconds left. Maybe tell us a little bit about what's the event on Thursday, if you don't mind.
The event on Thursday is several folks are participating. My co-author, James Endersby, and I are going to be talking about our book, but Deputy Chancellor Middleton is going to be there. The assistant principal at the New Battle High School is going to be there talking about, I think, about the battles and about her experience as an assistant principal at the high school. And and there's a couple other panelists that I just – oh, my goodness. Oh, excuse me. Dr. King, Wilma King, is going to be there.
Oh,
she's the chair of the Black Studies Department here on campus. And I am blanking on the name of the woman. She runs Granny's House here in town, and she's going to be there as well.
Pam Ingram.
Yes, pardon me.
And that'll be at 6 o'clock at Missouri Theater on Thursday. Well, that's all the time we have for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Michael Middleton, William Horner, and Mary Ratliff. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our broadcast each Monday afternoon on KBIA.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersections are broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersections produced by Casey Morrell, Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan's our technical director with production assistance from Rachel Gangware. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Famule. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.